Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Having just listened to this podcast, I realise I got a really bad cold, and also the pop filter on this microphone. I got a new pop filter. It's not very poppy, so it's very poppy. So I do apologise for the recording of this. It sounds very like nasally, and there's some popping, and there was some coughing, but I managed to edit that out. So there might be some weird bits where it sounds a bit weird, like I'm going into. Like I sound like Cher or something. So anyway, if you can't deal with this podcast, then I'm sure there'll be another one along shortly. Thank you very much. Welcome to the Psychovertical Podcast. It's me, Andy Kirkpatrick, back again. Oh God, that's not good, is it? My phone's gone off straight away. Oh God, what's going on? I'll keep this in. No, I'll cut it out. You'll never know it happened. Let me just check my phone. That's interesting. Oh God, I've gone back to the dark side. I've gone back to having a smartphone, which is not being good. The reason I went back to a smartphone was I just found like trying to do like banking, like every time you want to buy something, every time you wanted to do something with your bank, Bank of Ireland, you always had to be getting sent codes and swiping this and swiping that. And I had it onto my wife's smartphone, which is not very smart, because then she could, every time I bought something, she'd be like, what the hell's this? What's this? You're bloody buying here. Some kettle. What's a kettlebell? You're not getting into bell ringing or something, are you? So, so I had to get my own phone. And when I listen to podcasts, which just, probably do about 3 hours of listening to podcasts every day, I was having to upload it into some Sony, like, waterproof MP3 player, earphone things, which was just a bit of a pain. It was a bit very old school. It was, like, Sony stuff. It always reminds me of, like, how things used to be, technology, where you're always having to find it on your computer and nothing ever seemed to connect. Like, that was a good thing about Apple. When Apple things started appearing, normal people had them. Things just seemed to work, where before that nothing ever worked. You'd buy some bit of technology and you'd have to have like a huge VGA cable, and you'd have to get an adapter, and then that you'd have to get a new, you know, like card for your computer, and by the time you got it all to work, like the technology didn't work anymore, you know. So it was a constant battle for that. So unfortunately I did go back to having a smartphone. And when you don't have a smartphone, it's a little bit like everyone's like, you know, shooting up all the time, and you go like, oh, that's a bit antisocial. Like just sitting in my city, you come to visit for the weekend, and you're just sitting on the city like shooting up, but you end up like sat next to them like shooting up, going, oh, it's good, this, isn't it? It's good. get TikTok on. Oh, I've got a bit of TikTok. So not only was I able to be judgmental for a few years not having a smartphone, it's kind of doubly bad now, because I should know better and I'm doing it now. And Vanessa can always tell. She's like, you're not present. You're thinking about something, and it's probably because I've been arguing with somebody. Like sometimes I'll get into like an argument. Someone will say something like, you're a Nazi, and I'll sort of dwell on it. So anyway, if you call me Nazi, just, you know, I hate to admit it, but these things do kind of affect me, because I'm a sensitive person. Like, am I a Nazi? Like, you know, so um so yeah so So I'll be awake at like 2 a.m. going, am I a Nazi? Am I a Nazi? And, so I'll be having breakfast. Instead of looking at my 2 children and my beautiful wife, I'll be thinking, am I a Nazi? Am I a Nazi? Am I a Nazi? So it's, so which is like, you're not present, like you're somewhere else. I'm like, am I a Nazi? Vanessa, am I a Nazi? And she, Vanessa, I don't think Vanessa knows what a Nazi is. A Nazi, what's a Nazi? So probably think it's like a game, like a sort of board game. So I need to sort of knock that on the, I need to knock the phone on the head. I guess I'm going to have to just go back to, maybe I'll just need to just get loads of like cash and just start, or getting loads of like traveler's checks or something, or post office things, and start sending them to people or something. I don't know. It is like the mafia. You get really pulled into this kind of world of having to have a phone, and I'm not really bothered. Like my brother-in-law, we were once going driving somewhere and we were lost, and I was like, put on Google Maps, because I had a dumb phone, I couldn't go use good Google Maps. I was like, put on Google Maps and work out where we're going. He was like, oh no, I don't put anything on, any Google things on, because they can track me or something. So I probably got that from each other, that kind of mental thing. And I'm like, I'm sure they can track you anywhere, And am I a Nazi? And it's funny, the Nazi thing. I know anybody who's listened to this podcast in the past will probably have heard the story about how my granddad actually, he wasn't a Nazi. He was a communist, which is kind of a Nazi. That's technically not true. Anyway, communists and Nazis, they're all the same to me. But I'm just ignorant. I just kind of look at how things seem, and that's what I go by rather than what people tell me. But my granddad actually did fight Nazis in the streets of Hull, in a field in Hull, in a famous riot between the communists, the communist dock worker types, union people, and Oswald Mosley. But it's a cool story. Anyway, so I'm sure I'm not a Nazi, because I think, like when you hear a story like that when you're a kid, you don't want to be like on the other side of what your granddad, you got your granddad like going, oh, I never thought you'd turned into Nazi, all that kind of stuff. Well, that way from a Sheffield granddad. So, come on, love, give up this old Nazi malarkey. Anyway, I have become a bit radicalized recently, because for some reason, since the whole Guidegate that happened a few weeks ago, which has not continued, it's not been good, that whole thing. I did have some kind of interaction with somebody on Instagram, in that it was a woman who was a guide who basically was like, I feel sorry for you. Are you okay? You're such a bitter, twisted, misogynistic, asshole, Nazi type person, blah, 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 blah. And I have some faith in humanity, because I did start trying to explain that the whole point of what I was saying was it doesn't aid somebody, woman, whatever, to be view themselves as a victim. You're against the world, and the guides are all men, and they're all misogynistic assholes, and hyper masculine. That doesn't aid you or other women in trying to become guides. And surprisingly, she actually, surprisingly for a woman, like I'm gonna go balls deep on this now. I'm just gonna become a Nazi. I think I'm just gonna, if everyone keeps thinking I'm a Nazi. And this is what happened, I think, with working class people in the UK, and probably the working class people everywhere in the world, where they were constantly being called racists. So they were just like, fuck it, I'm just going to become a racist then. Even black people were like, So I've told this story on here about this taxi driver who once told me that he started voting for the National Front, which were like the sort of white nationalist party. And he said, yeah, and all my black mates would as well if they could. That kind of sums up this this kind of weird, twisted reality we live in. So anyway, but this person did seem to get my point that I wasn't saying that women are rubbish and the guides are making it easy for women to be guides. She did actually see my point, so that was good. Because in a way, the point that the reverse meaning of what I was saying was, no, the guides are all misogynistic, macho assholes who are stopping women from becoming mountain guides. Like, I think Sweden's got like 3 mountain guides who are women, and I think the UK's got 11, and I don't think many of those are actually working as mountain guides. So maybe, I got through to, I said, like, oh, maybe you're right. Maybe the guides are all, you know, all Nazis. So yes, that was good. It was good. Maybe I just didn't read it right. I often read comments and I kind of read, I'm sensitive. I kind of half read them because I just can't deal with my bandwidth is not great sometimes. So yeah. But anyway, but unfortunately, the whole guide gate has led on to a further thing where I think some people, because I used to have like quite a big Instagram account and I deleted it. I think some people out there thought they'd defeated the Kirkpatrick and had disappeared somewhere, but the Guidegate thing seemed to finding Bin Laden. Like, you know, certain people realised I was still around and I was still a dissident and I was still spreading dangerous things about, you know, about being empowered and all that kind of stuff you don't want to. You know, that you people are victims, all that kind of stuff. So yeah, so I've had a bit of a campaign since I did the last podcast. Basically, people being notified who follow me, like famous people, saying, "Do you realise you follow this person? I'm very worried about him. He seems to have turned into a Nazi and all this kind of stuff." So which strangely enough, and also on like open forums, like, do you know Andy? I'm worried about Andy Kirkpatrick. I think he's mentally ill and all that kind of stuff. But weirdly, I've gained about 500 new followers or something since then. But unfortunately, because of this, it's kind of radicalized me. It's made me a bit of like FU. Kind of like, you want to see me radicalized? Well, this is me being radicalized. And I've done like a whole ton of mad posts about all sorts of stuff that would completely turn one of these sensitive, fragile, you know, wokistas into make their hair go white or something. They'll probably look like they've been in the Hanoi Hilton for 3 years in a, you know, after reading my Instagram posts. So yes, that's what happens. So I've probably lost about 300 followers because of that. But I've had quite a lot of emails and messages from people who kind of been very supportive. I've not had any from people being unsupportive. They'd probably just unfollow you, which is interesting because everybody. People, there's plenty of people who are putting forward an opposite the narrative. Like mine's a counter narrative. There's lots of people putting forward the narrative all the time. So there's plenty of people who people can follow and listen to and agree with and nod and and clap and salute and goose step and all that kind of stuff. But so you realize that just by being a bit of a twat, basically, which is what I am. Other twatty people are like, oh my god, that guy, you know, he used to be famous, like he used to be well known, and look, he's being a total twat. I feel happier in my own twattiness now to carry on not saying anything, but in my brain, like saying it or screaming or all that kind of stuff. So that's been good. Someone did helpfully give me some recommendations that I should have 2 different accounts, one for all my mad stuff and the other one for all my high quality free content. And I said it nicely, but I was basically like, I have to sift through every other person's account telling me about global warming, the racial reckoning, you know, capitalism, you know, all this kind of stuff. Like everything, you know, everywhere you look, someone's telling you to bloody recycle something. So why can't I do what I want to do? And also, I'm not trying to be popular. You might have noticed I'm not trying to be popular. I'm not trying to get anyone to follow me. I'm not like, follow me, everybody. You know, that's not my aim. And I'm also not a brand, and I'm not a business. I'm not some kind of public entity who is trying to get, well, I could just go out and buy, you know, a million followers for my Instagram thing, hashtag high heel shoe, smiley face, something on fire, wheelie bin. So yeah, I think that's one thing people don't realize. Like, we live in this sort of attention economy, but mine's like an unattention, like a ADHD economy or something, or attention focus syndrome, so for me, it's not about being popular, or it's not even about being right. It's about the freedom to be wrong, you know, the freedom to just, if some stupid thought comes into my head, why can't I just stick it on Instagram? Like, who really cares? Like, I've got about 1,300 followers. Like, who really cares? And most of those followers are sex bots saying, do you want to see sexy pictures of me in my underwear? So they don't care, those people. I keep emailing them, but they never reply. And, you know, so it's, it doesn't really matter, does it? Like, it doesn't, like, it, like, it doesn't really matter. Like, today, let's have a look on my Instagram. Today, I was asking, like, what happened to the pipe bomber from January the 6th? Like, what happened to him? I'd love to know. You know, does anybody care? Does anybody care? Like, am I a threat to the world by asking a question like that? Like, what does he really mean? That sounds like a Nazi kind of thing. Does he know this pipe bomber? Is it a conspiracy theory that maybe there wasn't a pipe bomber, or, you know, blah, blah, blah? So I think I remember when I was in New Zealand and someone said to me, oh, I love your Instagram account. This is when I had like a much bigger Instagram account. Like, you're just always trolling everybody. And I was like, I'm not trolling anybody. I was like, really, like, shocked. Like, how dare you say that? I don't think I really understood what trolling was, but I guess I am. I'm just like trolling all these sort of sanctimonious, puritanical, you know, people who are fragile kind of people. So that's what I'm doing. But anyway, I decided to pen this this jokey. I will get to some climbing stuff in a second. But this was I had a picture of Russell Brand. I'm not actually a massive fan of Russell Brand, just because when I used to do work in London, I met quite a few people who'd like worked for Russell Brand. It kind of put me off, but people probably say the same about me. So anyway, but Russell Brand, give him his due. Like, he's not playing he obviously has some sort of fuck you money sort of saved up somewhere, because he's not, he could be Piers Morgan by now. So I saw he was on like Fox News. I thought, oh, that is interesting when you see Russell Brand on Fox News. Traitor, class traitor. So I penned this little post. I'll read it out because it's kind of funny, because people actually thought it was true. So if anybody read it, it's not true. So this is kind of a spoof of the message that was being sent to people who had any kind of connection to me. Hi, I noticed you follow Russell Brand. I wanted to check if you knew he was on Fox News recently. I'm concerned about his mental health, and perhaps he's struggling with sluggish schizophrenia, depression, or a sense-offending disorder. I'm sure, like you, I've always been a huge fan of Russell Brand's comedy and films, and even paid to see Arthur. But recently, he seems to be struggling with his mental health, and I think he needs help, or at least for you to stop following him out of compassion. Instead of talking about drinking, drug, shagging and football, which were hilarious, now it's all lockdowns, COVID, vaccine injuries, the biosecurity state, global elites, 15-minute cities, CBDCs, and the WEF, whatever they are. Now he's gone full MAGA and is spreading far-right talking points like freedom of speech, human rights, and anti-war propaganda. Thank God Michael McIntyre stays in his lane and just talks about his wife. Anyway, I'm anxious about Russell's mental health and hope he can get help from the people around him, or at least have his ability to make a living dismantled out of compassion. Perhaps he needs an intervention, in brackets, maybe a call to the police hate line and a non-hate crime conviction might help. I hear Pfizer is working on a new drug called Prozium 2, which might help Russell to think straight again, and perhaps, but only for his own good and out of love and compassion, maybe a neurosurgical treatment, like a lobotomy. Russell is a big fan of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, after all, so I'm sure once he's better, he'll understand what's in everyone's best interest. Sorry to contact you via DM, but I'm just worried about Russell. And I signed it. It's a German for good day, and it was from the Eric Mickey or something, who was like the top Stasi guy in East Germany. Anyway, it is kind of comical, this whole world of this kind of I'm really worried about you kind of thing. So yeah, I've seen someone from UK Climbing might be monitoring this now, or someone from the Neo-Stasi. So I'm going to add an observation here, which is very controversial. And if you're a woman, prepare yourself, because this is just an observation. I have been coming to this conclusion for a long, long time. Like I've mentioned on this, the problem of like feminizing men and feminized society, which could be which sounds like it's going to be a good thing, but potentially it might not be a good thing. And so one thing is, when I look at like the state of climbing and the state of science and STEM and all these kind of things, it kind of makes me wonder if the more women involved, the more trouble there is, because the more of all this shit sort of seems to crop up. Like when I started climbing, there were probably for every 10 men there was like one woman climber, and there was no stuff about all the stuff about stuff. People just went climbing, but now it just seems to be lots of stuff and not so much about climbing. So if you are a woman, if you are of the female persuasion and you are entering something like caving or paragliding or something, like something that's yet to be fully tainted by all this political bollocks, is just stick to it. Maybe women aren't very good at this kind of stuff, like techie stuff and all that kind of stuff. So maybe that's why they just create all this fannying on to try and, I don't know. It's a funny old thing, isn't it, life? So anyway, so back to my son will probably be waking up soon. He had a late nap. So I'm gonna quickly go over something that I wrote recently for the Mountain Log, which sounds like there's a joke in there somewhere. Like an Irish mountaineering magazine. Not many magazines left anymore. Well, not there's none that will publish anything I wrote, because everything, I'm sort of blacklisted for everything. So for some reason I bring it on myself, don't I, really? So I have to write something every few months for this magazine, and it's always getting an email like, Andy, can you write something ASAP for this column? And I'm like, oh yeah, I've nearly started, and I always have to pull it together, but I don't get paid for it. I just do it out of the kindness of my heart. And so this month issue, I wrote something I had this idea about writing something about first aid kits. I know it's very boring, but I quite like taking a really boring subject and trying to make it interesting, rather than an interesting subject and making it boring, which a lot of people are very good at. So I once wrote an article. It was about waterproof zips, and I probably wrote about 800 words on waterproof zips. And the only reason I wrote it as the title was Water Zip Down. So I'll drink some tea, hold on. So I thought, like, first aid kits, now there's something interesting to write about. So I wrote a big chunk of it, and I give it to him, and he was like, that's crap. So I'm like, it's crap, but it's free. So anyway, so I had to write it again, because although it's crap and it's free, still has to, it's like, we're not talking about the internet here, we're talking about physical magazine. So I rewrote it. So I thought I need to practice my reading. So I thought I'd read it out and see what you think. If you get the mountain log, and you're gonna get this a bit early, so I do apologize. Anyway, so it's called The Mountain Survival Kit, an unconventional and idiosyncratic, in brackets, or idiotic approach to mountain first aid kits for day trips and expeditions. One type of expedition member that always creeps me out, perhaps unfairly, is the individual who's gone beyond the basic one-day first aid course, the type of thing the Red Cross or St. John's Ambulance run, and instead has invested in a week-long advanced or wilderness first aid course. With the former minimalist training, you can learn how to do CPR, cut some burns, choking, etc., and for less than €100, it is something everyone should do. So I'm talking there about the Red Cross, you know, first aid courses, basic first aid course. Although a lot of that stuff you could just like print it on an A4 sheet of paper and stick it on the back of the toilet door, and you just learn it that way. With the latter, the advanced stuff, you learn open heart surgery, brain transplants, and limb amputations, or at least that's what you'd imagine when you look through the person's medical kit. Or should I say medical luggage? Although such an investment should be saluted, what creeps me out is that in my experience, such wilderness first aid responders have an almost fundamentalistic fervour for martyrdom, only not theirs, but yours. They cannot wait for someone to get a deep gash so they can stop sewing up bits of chicken and sew up a person instead, or be so close to death that they require an IV, which, if nothing else, will reduce the weight of their ambulance-sized med kit by a kilo or two. The first time I met one of these first aid jihadis was on a trip to Greenland, when it appeared we were so overloaded with food, fuel and kit that we could not even take a book, and yet could carry bags of IV, which I pointed out would freeze rock solid as soon as we stepped onto the ice, which they did. I tried to bring this person, who was probably marching around with a stethoscope around their neck. She did have a stethoscope and a spy monometer, Google it, it's one of those things that check your pressure, in the first aid kits, that I've been on many expeditions far from help and beyond a roll of duct tape, I've never even carried a first aid kit. In the end, we carried it all across Greenland, but when it came to the primary injuries we faced, which were related to skin rubbing against skin and pulled muscles, the first aid kit supplied nothing, had nothing to offer. At the extreme, you have people like Paul Ramsden, a health and safety professional, a man who's been on more trips than Marco Polo, whose overall view on first aid is just to take nothing, that your body will deal with the pain long enough for the rescue to get to you. If it can't, then you'll die anyway. In truth, he tends to carry some hospital-grade pain relief in case you're forced to lay in a tent for a few days with a broken leg, and then some low-dose pain relief for toothache, a common problem in expeditions, probably due to high sugar drinks and altitude and cold. Stuff for diarrhea, although it's best to get it out, and that's it. Such a minimalist approach is one in which you forgo the plastic airway and face shield and just safety pin the casualty's tongue to their lip. Close to home, and for Irish hills, remember this is for Irish audience, you tend to get a number of first aid kit types, First, you have the majority who don't carry any kind of first aid kit. After all, with a phone, you can just call the mountain rescue out, right? Then you have the ones who carry a first aid kit they bought from Halfords, but have no clue what's in the bag, even though they'll lug it around for years on end, just in case. Such people tend to be more of a liability, as this kit gives them a false sense of security, and they will be bewildered when the day finally comes when the kit is needed, and they break the wrapper only to find it contains a warning triangle, a high-vis vest, and a tow rope. Store-bought kits are better than nothing, but they're just a starter for something that's going to work. And then you have the people who, as the wilderness qualified, take it too far and carry a first aid kit that's so heavy and bulky that they end up collapsing due to exhaustion, and someone has to use it to bring them back from the dead or just call them out rescue. Maybe I read Lofty Wiseman's Survival Handbook too many times as a kid, but I've always approached the first aid kit concept as more of a survival kit. What is a first aid kit? First, I think you need to both make your own kit from scratch and to make a kit that solves a myriad of problems. So repair or keep your body and gear and ambition going forward. First aid kits are always designed to hit the cheapest price point, and so making your own allows you to ditch all this fluff and make what you carry, which is still minimalist, do what's necessary when necessary. The following is my approach to such a kit, as it's just a guide, and although I might make adjustments for a longer trip, the idea is to just carry all this kit all the time and forget about it until a problem comes up. Be that a tick in your leg, a broken head torch, a compound fracture. No, this is not for alpine climbing or multi-pitch climbing where something much smaller would be carried or not, but rather for general hill crag use in the UK. So, how are you with me so far? So, first thing is a kit pouch. So this is what you're going to put all your stuff in. The kit needs to be in an easily identified, robust, waterproof roll-top bag around 1 litre in size, like made by Sea to Summit, Exped, Life Systems, etc. You will subdivide the contents into zippered, colour-coded ditty bags, like Tough Bags or Look on Etsy, linked together and connected to the main bag, and subdivide again using small Ziploc bags. Mark the bag with contact details and add a lanyard and medium-sized wire-gate carabiner so it can be secured inside the lid of a pack or a belay or to a pack in high winds. Add a stuck glow tape to the buckles so you can find it in the dark without a torch. So basically you want something that's going to keep everything completely dry inside your bag, and everything in your bag needs to be in a bag, and everything in those bags needs to be in a bag, if that makes any sense. And you want to sort of divide it into your main parts of your kit, really. So when you're going to get like your tweezers or whatever, you don't have to like open the thing. It's got all your sewing stuff in there as well. Other stuff you might put in there, maybe it'd be worth, if you're not got a good memory, it would be worth laminating like a card, like a laminated card won't take any room up in there. But you could put in like how to do CPR. Like you could Google how to do CPR, the current way to do CPR, because it's always changing, and print that out, stick that on there, just so you know. Because like I would say like CPR is probably the skill that's probably it's the one skill that a lot of people think they know until it happens. Like I've been somewhere where someone was dying and people were doing CPR on them, and you know it's not something that you want to be like, am I doing the right thing here? So yeah, so it's that's a good thing. And you don't want it to be too big. You want something like imagine Nalgene bottle size or smaller. It's something that can just go into your bag or into the lid of your rucksack. That's just going to be, you don't have to think about it. Like we're not talking about lightweight alpinism on the north face of Makalu here. We're talking about going out in the hill. So everything in here is meant to be sort of light. So the contents. So number one, emergency bandage, aka Israeli bandage. Although the classic bandage has been around for thousands of years, it is central and is a central component of first aid kits, wrapped in a little crinkly plastic wrapper. The modern emergency bandage, invented by Israeli military medic Bernard Banatan in the 80s, should now be viewed as a standard for all kits. Part bandage, part field dressing, designed to be far more effective at applying pressure to a wound and much easier to secure in place due to its elasticity, width and closure bar. The closure gives the user a way to apply extra pressure on a wound or twist it to create a tourniquet. Although you might get shot by an irate farmer, such a tactical bandage is very appropriate for the type of messy head or limb injuries outdoor casualties suffer. The design helps keep the bandage in place if you have to get yourself out of trouble and walk off a mountain. Speaking of trouble, an emergency bandage is also much easier to apply to yourself. So you can probably buy an Israeli bandage for about €5. And if you're going to buy one, I would buy two. And I would open one and I would practice with it, just so you know what it is and what it does. And I would, if you're going cragging and you've got your climbing partner, show them what it is, tell them how you open it and all that kind of stuff. And because, you know, it's like a 5 minutes, like, oh, look at this, I got this new kind of bandage. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's cool. Because it's basically, it's almost more like one of those, like, I don't know, it's the material, it's like more like an elastic knee brace kind of thing. But it has like a plastic part on it that allows you to get leverage on the bandage. It's just a lot better than the bandage you would get in a first aid kit, which is it's basically the cheapest thing someone's going to put in a first aid kit. It's almost like a tick box, like bandage, yes. But the size of the bandage and its ability to deal with something is not easy. Like if you're climbing on a crag, and like head injuries seem to be fairly common in rock climbing. You're climbing a crag, rock comes down, hits someone on the head. If you get a head wound, it tends to bleed quite a lot. Now, if you've got like an Israeli bandage, you can open the plastic, you can pull the bandage out, and within the bandage is like a field, it's more like a field dressing. You have some of them have that kind of hemostatic stuff that stops the blood, but it's like more like a bandage built into like a wound dressing. So you can get that on, and you can cover up the wound, wrap the bandage around the wound quite quicky, much quicker than opening this plastic bag with this bandage in, and then trying to find some gauze or something in your first aid kit, which is bound to just blow away and all that kind of stuff. So, it's a good thing to carry. Although twice the price of a standard bandage, €10 versus €5. And I think you can get them cheaper than €10, which is why they're not part of a standard first aid kit. These bandages are packed very robustly, so they are ideal for a mountain kit. It will last for approximately 8 years. I would get a 4-inch version and buy two in order to open one for you and your partner to practice beforehand. So yeah, they're bulkier than a normal bandage, but they're probably like the size of a packet of cigarettes kind of size. So highly recommended. Burn shields, this is number one. Number two. Any trip that involves using stoves runs a risk of burns, both directly from the stove itself or from spilt boiling water. Tired people can also set themselves or tents alight or pick up red-hot pans or stoves with bare fingers. In my climbing life, I've seen it all. Having some form of treatment for minor burns is important, so a few small packets of burn shield. So burn shield is almost like a gel kind of sort of plaster type kind of thing. And you can get bigger ones, but for your first aid kit, just get like the 10 centimeter by 10 centimeter size, and maybe carry like, between 2 and 4 or something, depending on how big your first aid kit is. it's kind of handy. For bigger burns, you're either going to die or you're going to get rescued. Like, some people say it's good to carry cling film. Cling film might have an advantage both for wounds and for burns. But in my, having never used it, my brain, practical brain, is that when it come to it, you'd probably just find it was all just stuck together. It wasn't gonna do anything. So, anyway. The next thing is 3M Transport Tape. There are many kinds of tape you can carry, such as paper micropore, elastoplast, Muller fabric tape. But Transport Tape, 5 centimeters by 0.9 meters, works best due to being very sticky, tough, waterproof, and breathable. This can be used like a makeshift plaster or for securing a dressing, but it will often be used to cover hot spots on your feet or frost nip on your face, store in a Ziploc bag. So you generally have, in the past, you'd always have this like paper, like micropore tape or some kind of paper tape in your first aid kit, but when you wanted it, you'd often find that it was kind of, you couldn't use it. It was just, it's gone all manky. When it comes to like climbing, you're probably best carrying some Muller tape, like sports tape, on your harness somewhere, like where your knife is. Because that can be used for like repairing, you can repair ropes. You can use it to secure carabiners shut. You can use it on your fingers, which is what it's most supposed to be for. So having that kind of Muller tape should be on your harness, probably not in your first aid kit. Tough cut scissors. Although you can probably use a penknife, if you have scissors at just 10 grams, if you have a knife, I don't know. Having a pair of paramedic scissors comes in very handy. Get a set with bright coloured handles so you can spot them easily on the ground. Yeah, so it's a kind of a luxury having scissors in your first aid kit, but they are kind of handy if you do need them, and they're actually quite light, these kind of tough cut scissors. So, and then they should be able to cut through your trousers or whatever, or cut your toenails, or cut your transport tape, or cut your bandage, or whatever. So they are it's much easier than with trying to do it with a knife or something. Like a friend of mine, he broke his ankle in Antarctica, and when they got to the first aid place in Patriot Hills, they tried to cut his Sportiva Olympus Mons boots off, and he was like kicking them, like, because it cost him so much money, he got to take them off instead. So they are kind of handy, but that might be a luxury. Depends what you think. Wound cleaning. Carry 5 alcohol-free wipes in a Ziploc bag for wound cleaning, but add a small plastic bottle of iodine. Now, iodine, if you know what iodine is, it is actually very, very, very useful. So 30 milliliters of iodine is a very small bottle, but you can use it for a lot of things. It's good. You can use it in your throat, you can drink it, you can purify water with it, you can do all sorts of things. So this has too many uses to mention, from treating wounds, athlete's foot, to nuclear radiation. So yeah, so having some way of like cleaning up a wound is very handy if you're going to be out for a long time. Now, I'm sure I've told that story about once my finger got so infected in Yosemite that it was like, several times I couldn't get my gloves off because my finger was so infected. But anyway, so my finger was so excessive, it was like a big sausage. And there was a guy on our picnic table in the campsite. I was like, what do you think to my finger? He was like a doctor. I said, what do you think to my finger? And he was like, if you don't sort that out, you're gonna have to get your finger amputated. So I just put, I was like, what should I do? I was thinking, I have to use some serious first aid kind of stuff, go to the hospital. And he said, just wash it with soap. And I did, and it got better. So yeah, so keeping your wounds, depends where you are. Some places it's more important than others. Like in Yosemite, it's important because a lot of ledges and cracks are covered in like bacteria from like people weeing and all that kind of stuff. You could wee on it as well. That's one thing you can do. If you have an injury, just wee on it. If you've got like a, it's quite good. Dressings. Carry two sterile 10 centimeters by 10 centimeter dressings in a Ziploc bag. And ideally, make one quick clot style hemostatic dressing impregnated with coagulant. The latter style of dressing is highly desirable with a head wound, as you tend to get a lot of blood. So yeah, often you'll get first aid kits and just be full of all these dressings. Like if you're going to need them, if you're going to use, like, you're not going to ever use loads of dressings at once, you know. So if you use them, you can just replace them. So don't fill your first aid kit full of all these dressings. Plasters, a strip of water resistant elastoplast band-aid to cut to size, plus a mixture of waterproof plasters, including Opsit waterproof plasters, often used by tattoo artists, and Compeed. So Opsit are like those, they're kind of like a, they're quite a big, like, waterproof plaster that are, like, I've used those for, like, sea kayaking. They're quite good. In sea kayaking, you often get this weird thing where you get loads of blisters on your, under your skin, which is really, really weird. And I had it in Chile. You went to sea kayaking in Chile, all your fingers get covered in blisters. So you have to kill, it's something to do with the salt and the UV, or the water and the UV light. So then you have to wear gloves all the time. It's kind of worth having some rubber gloves in your first aid kit. Like, if you're gonna, maybe potentially use something like more like bike rubber gloves for mending bikes, something a bit tougher than medical ones, because you might have to put the gloves on and use them for something else. They're also quite good for setting on fire if you have to light a fire if it's all wet and horrible. So pain medication. So you see, like, we haven't got a lot of first aid stuff in there, so this is the pain medication. Paracetamol, in brackets Panadol, should be your standard over-the-counter OTC relief for pain, colds, and fever, as it has the least side effects, which is important if you're giving pain meds to someone else. That's why if you ever actually go up to, like, a St. John's ambulance person, if you're at somewhere and actually do have an injury and you've been seeing someone from St. John's sitting there for the last 20 years every time you've been somewhere, they often won't give you anything because they're afraid of being sued. But if they were to give you something, they'll probably give you paracetamol, because some people might, like, freak out or go mad or die if you give them something else. Ibuprofen, in brackets Nurofen, being an anti-inflammatory, is often recommended for muscle pain, but I would only use it if the pain has to be relieved in order to get down, in brackets such as shin pain. Otherwise, your body's inflaming for a reason, so leave it. Codeine is the strongest OTC, over-the-counter pain relief, you can get, and will be combined with paracetamol, tramadol. So you're not going to get just pure codeine, you're going to get a tablet that's like a mixture of codeine and paracetamol, which I think is maybe 10-20% codeine, whatever. I think it's actually quite hard to get some of these now, because so many people are addicted to codeine and all these kind of things, that it's quite hard to get from a pharmacy. If you want the strongest OTC pain relief, you can combine variations of paracetamol, ibuprofen, and codeine, paying attention not to double dose with paracetamol, so not Panadol and Tramadol. Does that make sense? So if you were to say, like, I'm going to take Panadol, Nurofen, and Tramadol, you're actually taking a double dose of paracetamol. There's Panadol and Tramadol, a paracetamol in them. I haven't included aspirin in here. I just ignore aspirin. If you want heavy duty drugs such as opioids, you should have some form of appropriate first aid training, such as a wilderness first aid certificate. Does that make sense? Like, you don't want to be, like, carrying this stuff on a trip unless you really know what it's doing, what are the effects, and everything else. It's not good. Ziploc, along with a laminated card detailing all the dosages of the meds. Because sometimes you might be somewhere as a child, and you need to give them something for, you know, they might smash the teeth or whatever. You might have to give them some of your meds from your first aid kit. And if you don't know what you should be giving a child, like, I can't remember what it is now, but you know, some things you don't want to be giving children. So it's worth knowing. I'll just take a massive big bottle of what's that stuff all the kids have? What does my son always say? I went Benadryl, any one of those things. Next, bad guts. Carry a sheet of water purification tablets and Imodium if the germs get in. Katadin Micropore MP1 is the most effective tabs, but they're expensive. So a cheaper chlorine dioxide tab, Life Systems or Portable Aqua are better for emergency use. Two diorite sachets come in handy for sickness or if you get heat injuries like heat exhaustion or sunstroke. And all that goes in a Ziploc bag as well. So if you were like on Mount Kenya, you'd want the Katadin Micropore tablets. But if you're just getting water out of a bog, you know, say you're up high and you're absolutely dying of thirst, and there's a boggy pool of water, which is there's a lot of them in Ireland, then you would use the something cheaper. You always want to get rid of, if you're ever getting stuff out of bogs and general mountain pools, you always want the water to be kind of clean already. So you can always filter it through something else before you put it into something else. So you can filter it through like your, you know, a t-shirt or something, or some kind of fabric like your buff or something to get any lumpy bits out. Again, it might be worth put on your zip on your card in this thing that's got all these details. Might be worth putting, including, you know, like how long you should have the tablets in the water for it to work. Cream, Savlon cream, and 15 grams, and Glide anti-chafe cream, 22 grams. Like anti-chafe cream is quite expensive, so you might be able to just put something else on, but it is much more effective than like Vaseline or something. You could put a little tin of Vaseline in. And I think like chafing is quite a big issue on longer trips, expedition kind of trips. So hardware, carry a few medium size safety pins, which can be used as pins when sewing as well, plus one nappy and one kilt pin, as these have multiple uses, especially if the zipper busts on your jacket, sleeping bag or tent. So nappy pins and kilt pins are just much bigger versions of safety pins and are less likely to like pull apart under strain. Sterile, individually wrapped, carry a sterile or a couple of sterile, individually wrapped surgical blades. Like a surgical blade is much better at cutting something, you know, a fine cutting than a pen knife is. Like a pen knife is not going to cut anything, any like skin type stuff. A tick remover, either a card or tweezers, and Victorinox micro tweezers and a toothpick. A toothpick is actually quite important if you're on a long trip, because if you get food stuck in your teeth, it's actually a good way of ending up with like a gum infection. So you could also include floss in there, but this is not really including like, you know, it's not including like toothpaste and stuff. Now, LED light. In terms of survival and accident rescue avoidance, a light source is one of the best tools in your armory. Carrying the smallest but most effective mini LED light in your kit is recommended. This can act as a backup to your partner's light if it gets broken or lost or a dead battery, but it's also at hand if you need to find items in your kit in the dark. The Petzl E-Light, 26 grams, or Black Diamond Flare, 27 grams, are ideal choices, or go for a non-head torch micro keychain design like the Princeton Tech Pulsar, 7 grams, or Atom Light, 5 grams. You can also get one that's, it's probably cost less than £5. It's like round with an LED on it, which is also very, very small, probably weighs 7 grams as well, and carry a spare battery as well. Like are these the small LED ones, which like size are almost about a slight thumb size. They're like flat. They will last for quite a long time, enough to get down. And like several times in my climbing life, I thought I was going to get benighted because something had happened to my head torch, or we had no head torch. So having some form of light in your bag is highly recommended. It will save your ass one day. Now this is another unconventional one. Fire steel, although viewed as a bushcraft as bushcraft kit for bearded men who hang out in the woods. A micro ferro rod. This one, the one I'm talking about here, is 30 millimeters by 4.5 millimeters, and it weighs 0.01 grams. Can be struck with a ceramic razor blade to create a spark that will light both gas or petrol stoves. This will save your bacon when your lighter is wet. Fire steel works wet or dry, or if you're not cooking bacon. The ceramic razor can do anything a razor can, but it will not rust due to their tiny size. Join both of them with a short length of bright cord. So you're gonna have to, for one of these, you're gonna have to go on some wacky some kind of like alt-right website, survival prepper website. There's in the UK, I can't think what they're called, but there are some in the UK. There's lots in America, as you can imagine. So a ceramic razor blade is just exactly the same as a razor blade, but like I say, it doesn't rust, but it does that. Like having, for some reason, I don't know what it is, because I'm not a bushcraft person, but some things will work with a ferro rod, create a spark, but some things won't. I don't know what it is. Like a penknife sometimes won't work, but like this. But anyway, a ceramic razor blade does work. So, and that, the weight of this is like, we're talking like 0.2 grams. It doesn't weigh anything. And having been on many a trip where when nothing would light the stove, like all the lights stopped working, all the matches got wet, you know, the sparker on the jet boil just stopped working. It really is like, it is the end of your trip if you can't get your stove to work. So this tiny little thing is an absolute lifesaver. So sewing kit, needle threader, which is one of the little plastic things that you stick through the needle to pull the thread through. Doesn't weigh anything, be useful for something else. You could use it to as a stove pricker. Several needles, number 7 embroidery and number 18 needles, or sail repair needles, in a sewing needle tube, like a little tube, a bit like those, you can use those little things as well, mechanical pencils, the lead, where you get the spare lead in those little tubes. They actually work quite well as well. Rubber thimble, like thimbles are kind of useful if you're doing heavy duty sewing. 2 buttons, small strip of Velcro, a patch of fleece, extra strong thread on a machine bobbin. So sewing machine bobbins are really tiny little bobbins that you can use. They're very good. Odds and ends, a cut down spork. Spoons are magic; they just disappear. So that's kind of self-explanatory. You'll often on any trip you're going to lose your fork or your spoon. So having a spoon, like a bit of a spoon in your first aid kit, is actually kind of helpful. You probably use it for something else. Pencil wrapped in gaffer tape. It's good to have something to write on, and it's good to have to write something right with. So heat the tape over a flame to make air matte patches. So if you get a puncture in a thermarest, which you often will, and it'll often happen when you have no repair kit, is what you do is you create a, you, well, ideally you make a smallest patch, like an inch size patch, and you will hold it over the flame of a stove until it starts to melt and starts to get all molten. Then you're going to stick it onto the hole and then let it cool down. And then you can do the same with a larger one, stick over the top of the other one, and et cetera, until you've got like an effective, like it not, might not be 100% effective, but it's a lot more effective than having nothing on there. What else? Writer's Rain notebook, 3x2, tiny little notebook, like tiny. It's got like 10 pages in it, really, really tiny, but you can write on it when it won't get wet, which is useful. Now, like, yeah, like again, like having my experiences, there are a lot of places where you have to write a note to somebody, like we've gone down, you know, we're bivvied here, or, you know, forgot this, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of reasons why you need to leave a note for somebody that can be really, really important. So having a notebook is very good. 5 meters of number 36 bank line, and 5 meters of 1.18 micro Kevlar cord wrapped on a card spool. So Bankline is kind of like much thinner version of like paracord. You could, is it thinner than 1 mil cord? Anyway, but it's kind of useful. It's useful to have cord for all sorts of reasons, and the Kevlar cord is just kind of, you could just have the Kevlar cord, like 5 meters of Kevlar cord, and a card stool is like a credit card piece of plastic, and just wrap it around that. 1 meter of 550 cord, which is like power cord, which you're going to use that as a spare shoelace or for cordy stuff. Mini signal mirror used for tick hunting and checking skin frostbite damage, or you could use it as a signal mirror. 8 centimeter hacksaw blade, which is like a hacksaw's blade the size of your finger. Usually you'd have it in a piece of, you'd keep it in something, piece of, what do you call it? Shrink wrap. You'll see that if you go on a Wacky Woo website where they sell ferrule rods and stuff, you'll find that it's like a hacksaw is that's more for expedition kind of stuff, but it's surprising how you often need to cut something, and you'll find that unless you've got a penknife with a saw on it, it's actually quite useful. Like for a proper expedition, you would add a lot more stuff in here. You'd probably add some sort of epoxy glue, you'd add all sorts of extra things. A pair of earplugs. It's always good to have earplugs for various reasons. A whistle, a little whistle. A stove pricker. You could put an MSR stove tool as well in there. A couple of zip ties. I'd also include maybe some strimmer cable for use with mending cams. Mending the triggers on cams for expedition-y kind of stuff, and that they can also be used. You can also set fire to them if you're lighting a fire and it's all wet. On an expedition, I would include a small multi-tool like a Gerb and Dime, as well as a small file, Allen key, spare crampon bale, etc. Micro Kevlar cord wrapped in a card spool. I've already got that. So that's all there. So I had an interesting response. So that's basically it. That was. But the idea is you have a kit that isn't just this thing that lives in your bag and you never use it. It's more like something you might use quite often when you go out. It's like, oh, I haven't got a tin opener. You can get a thing. It's called like it's like an Australian army spoon. It's called like a ridiculous eating device, and it's a cross between one of those army tin openers, which are actually quite a useful thing to have in your kit. Maybe think about getting one of them, but it's got a spoon built into it, but it's like a really tiny spoon, but you could use it. So that's maybe, it's worth like looking into the whole Wacky Woo survival world and see what stuff, that might apply. Anyway, so I'll read this, and I'm gonna have to finish because I think my son will be waking up in a minute. So this is from Justin. Great post, Andy. Refreshing. A couple of years ago, I was cragging next to a guy who took a nasty ground fall. He was very lucky, as his injuries weren't life-changing or ending, but he was knocked out, bleeding, and in bad shape. His partner had just finished a Wilderness First responder course the week prior, and after the fall went to full first aid algorithm mode. The partner was borderline panicking, but did a fine job, and we all stabilized the guy and rolled him off his harness full of cams. I was in a mat rescue team for 10 years, and in my experience, there's basically nothing you can do without ALS, advanced kit, and drugs. You simply have to wait for rescue. I tried to calm the partner down, explaining he was doing great and that we just had to wait. Once the rescue arrived, there was a doctor who took control of medical. The partner talked to the doc and said, "Damn, I forgot to check for battle sign." To which the doc said, "So what? What could you have done?" It really is empowering, but I wish more people understood that accident victims in remote settings are either stable or going to die. In my years on the team, we only had three subjects who were truly on the edge. In two cases, the only reason they survived is because we immediately had a helicopter that flew us in and then the patient out. The third died during transport while we were in brutal conditions at night. Every other victim was either miserable or already dead, as it simply takes a long time for help to arrive. It wouldn't surprise me if this story is a bit different in Europe. I'm in the US, where the travel times for helicopters are incredibly short and therefore fast, and the rescue services are world class. I hope you have some good points. I posted blah blah blah. I think what did I reply? Thanks, Justin. It's a great insight. I have a friend who had his arm ripped off by a boat propeller, well, twisted off, and he went a pretty long time without pain meds before he saw a professional. In fact, he said he didn't feel anything until the surgeon poured ice onto his stump. He had his arm sewn back on. Also, I have a friend who wrapped down El Cap with a missing finger. Oh, and you've got Joe Simpson and Doug Scott crawling down mountains to survive. I'm not sure if I included it in the piece, but I once got a nasty burn on my thumb after picking up a frying pan that was very hot. I thought the stove was off, but it had a slight flame still, and thought it might be trip ending. It really hurt. All I did was put my hand in a pan of water straight away and slept with it in the pan until morning, and somehow the thing was 100% better. I think the aim of such a first aid kit is really a patch-up kit that aims to carry out makeshift repairs so you can either get down without doing too much damage or give the illusion of control. But really, when it comes to an accident, it's all down to one's ability to be stoical about it. So yeah, so there you go. Something to think about. I don't know if anybody carry first aid kits? Do you know what's in it? Have you ever used it? Did you just buy it off the internet? I definitely think starting with a blank slate, get your first aid kit, look it through it. First of all, get rid of all the stuff that doesn't work anymore because it's out of date or it's all stuck together. And then just make something that's like practical, pragmatic, multifunction, and is going to, it's going to make your life easier and solve problems. Maybe it's not a survival kit, maybe it's more like a kind of problem solving kit, really. So there's like so much information on the internet and books and stuff about, you know, what to have, but you always have to remember that you're not a professional first aid person, you're an amateur. So you really want, you know, you're not a trained human body repair technician. You're just someone who's there. It's like when you get a, you know, you can change the tires of a, you know, a flat tire on a car, but you can't drain the oil or whatever. So it's same with people, really. And a lot of it is, having been in some accidents with people, a lot of it is just down to staying calm. That's the most important thing, is not to freak out, not to panic. You know, even if the person's going to die, it doesn't help them to know it, even if they know it anyway. But, you know, just be calm and don't make a bad situation worse by doing something crazy. Like, I'm just going to solo off down here. I'm just going to solo up here. I'm just going to, you know, I'm going to lower you down here. You're like, don't make it worse. Just try and stop, think about it, make a plan, you know, do it. And, so yeah, that's some advice. You know, have a cigar in your first aid kit. You can just get out and just like have a little smoke, make a cup of tea, have a think about it. Like, right, yeah, that bone is sticking out of your leg. That's not good. You know, it's ruining the line of your trousers. So yeah, humor is probably the best form of medicine, unless you've got asthma. Steve Coogan joke, that one. So anyway, so I shall leave you now. I shall go and see if my son is awake. Anyone who's been nice to me recently and telling me that I'm not mad, I do appreciate it. Like I do appreciate it. Like I don't want to be mad. I want to be helpful and useful to the world. So until next time, and I am I am working towards my other podcast. I just need to draw a picture to go on the thing, but I've not got around to it yet. I've got some funny takes about the world on my other podcast that's coming soon. So anyway, stay safe and don't be a Nazi.